Good thing I didn't use the big gavel. Good afternoon, and thank you all for coming to apparently the first House Finance Committee meeting of 2005. Today we have Eddie Jeans with us. He's the director of the Division of School Finance, and he's going to give us an overview on the funding formula. With us today, though we are informal, we have Representative Holm, Representative Kelly, Representative Foster, myself, Representative Chenault, Representative Hawker, Representative Wyrock, Representative Stoltz, and Co-Chair Kevin Meyer. If any of you want to watch the screen, you're more than happy to come up behind us so you can see what's going on. I see most of you are educators or in the education field and probably know this better than most. So with that, Eddie, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The purpose of the meeting today is to give the committee members and staffers of this new legislative session an overview of the foundation program and how the public school funding formula works in the state of Alaska. On your desk in front of you, you should have two documents. The first one is simply a copy of the PowerPoint presentation that I'll be going through, and it has three slides per page with an area to write notes as we go along. That's right there. Representative Meyer?
I don't think so.
Well, we got everything but, I think.
There's an extra one here.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Looks like they did full page.
Okay, they did full page.
Yeah, we got that all.
Okay.
We're ready.
It's on. Okay. How's that? Okay. Thank you. The second document is Public School Funding Program Overview, updated January 2005. I encourage legislators and staffers to keep a copy of this, because if you have any questions about the foundation program, either myself or Mindy Lobaugh on my staff can answer just about any question right from this document. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'm going to go ahead and start with the PowerPoint presentation. First of all, the public school funding formula was adopted under Senate Bill 36 that was enacted in 1998. The first year of implementation was 1999. And the public school funding formula is defined in Alaska Statute 1417. This presentation provides an overview of the calculation of adjusted average daily membership. We refer to that as ADM. The calculations of basic need, which is the entitlement under the state's funding formula. Then the components of basic need, in other words, who's going to pay for the entitlement, either state, federal, or local funds. Then there are additional funds above basic need that districts are eligible to apply for or qualify for. And then we'll get to the components of state aid. First of all, the foundation, the average daily membership requires school districts to report the number of students enrolled during the 20-day count period that ends the fourth Friday in October. This is the student count that we base the school district's entitlements on. It's due to the department within 2 weeks of the end of the 20-day count period. And then student projections are also due to us November 5th. Typically, these dates fall pretty close together. So we typically get our actual count for the current year as well as our projections within a couple days. School districts are also required to report to us through what we call OASIS, which is the Alaska the online Alaska School Information System. And that's the electronic student reporting system that school districts use to report student information to the department. Students that, who qualifies as a student, eligibility is a child who is 6 before the September 1st and who is under the age of 20 and has not completed the 12th grade. Through regulation, the department has defined completing the 12th grade as meeting your high school graduation requirements and passing your high school qualifying exam. Some of you may be familiar, some students will meet the credit requirement but don't pass the high school qualifying exam. This allows the school districts to continue to provide services to those students until they're 20 and or pass the high school qualifying exam. And Mr. Chairman, if anybody has questions as we go along, I tend to go pretty quick here, so just go ahead and stop me and I'd be happy to answer those. A child who is 5 years of age before September 1st, following the beginning of the school year, may enter kindergarten. Kindergarten is permissive in the state of Alaska, it is not required, although all of our school districts do offer some form of kindergarten program. Children with disabilities and active IEPs, individualized education program, can enter school at the age of 3 and are eligible for services through the age of 22. And so these would be your special education kids. The district's adjusted ADM is used to calculate the entitlement. There's basically 5 steps that we go through to arrive at the district's adjusted ADM. The first is we adjust each school for the school size, in other words, the student population of that school. After we've done that for all the schools in the district, we take that product and we multiply it times the district cost factor, which is step 2. Step 3 is the special needs factor, which is a 20% adjustment. Step 4, we add the adjustment for students requiring intensive needs services. These are your severely multi-handicapped students that typically require a full-time aid throughout the day. And the last step is we add the adjustment for correspondent students to arrive at the district's ADM.
Mr. Chairman, questions now?
You got a question, please.
Did the charter school authority pass after SB 36 was adopted or concurrent?
I believe it was right at the same time.
Concurrently? And then I was wondering where the charter school factors in on either your ADM adjustment or on your overview of your 5 elements.
Through the chair, Representative Wyrock, each charter school is reported independently to us, and then if they meet a threshold, which I'll get to in a moment here, of 150 students, they get counted as a separate school for funding purposes. Under the current law, if they're below 150 students, they get added to the largest school in the school district for adjustment purposes.
And is that added to the largest school a function of regulation or statute?
A function of statute.
And is that statute in the 1998 legislation, SB 36?
It was originally, yes, it was in Senate Bill 36, the original language, but that number was dropped to 150 a couple years later.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. The first adjustment that the department has to go through is we have to look at the size of the community in terms of the student population. And the statute says if you have a community of a school within a community of 100 or 10 to 100 students, it's adjusted as one K-12 school. Then we look at a community that falls in the range of 100 to 425. The statute tells us to split that student population into K-6 and 7-12. And in communities that have more than 425 students, the statute tells us to take each school and run it through the funding school size adjustment independently, with a few exceptions. Alternative schools with less than 200 students are added to the largest school in the district. And then the amendment for the charter school, which passed a couple years after Senate Bill 36, dropped it to a new threshold specifically for charter schools of 150. So right here, if you have an alternative school, which would be like an alternative high school, and you have fewer than 200 kids, they get rolled into the largest school in the district. If they have over 200, we get to count them as an independent school. Charter schools, the threshold is 150 students to count as a separate school.
That's true. Why the largest school in the district as opposed to the smallest school in the district?
Through the chair, that's the way it's written in statute. It directs us to do that.
And what was the basis for that?
That was part of the discussions during Senate Bill 36, and that's where the legislature decided to make that adjustment.
Well, remembering the battles of Senate Bill 36, the Department of Education, I think you were working there at the time, probably had an opinion. What was the department's position, which probably influenced the outcome, I imagine?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, on that specific item, I don't know that the department had a specific recommendation. There was the threshold. The department's concern at the time was that we didn't want to see a bunch of small schools pop up in larger communities for the purposes of size adjustment, and so we didn't recommend that there be the 200 threshold. But in terms of whether it went to the largest school or smallest school, I don't believe the department really formed an opinion on that.
Mr. Chairman, that'd be probably one of the few areas where the department, remember the politics of how and how it was micromanaged. I'll have to go back and look at the history, but I'll just leave that for now.
Thank you, Representative Stoltz. For the record, we have Representative Jewell, Representative Croft, and Representative Lamont join us. Go ahead, Eddie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple pieces about the public school system in Alaska. We have 53 school districts. 34 of those school districts are municipal school districts. In other words, have a taxing authority and are required to contribute local tax revenue to schools. And we have 19 regional education attendance areas in the state. We have approximately 502 what I would call school programs in the state. 481 of those are your typical brick and mortar. 481, excuse me. What you would call your community schools. We have 21 school districts that are operating correspondence programs. 10 of those 21 operate correspondence programs on a statewide basis. Mr. Chairman, we're going to use the Nome City schools as our example to walk you through how the actual calculations occur. And this gets to one of Representative Wyrock's questions earlier about the charter schools. You can see Nome has Anvil City Science Academy. That is their charter school. It has fewer than 150 students. And because the law requires us to add it to the largest school, in this case, in Nome, it would be added to the elementary school for the purposes of school size adjustment. So this slide just explains that process where we've taken the 395 students in the elementary school, added the charter school of 44. So for the purposes of school size adjustment, we're going to use an enrollment of 439. Mr. Chairman, this table here is the actual school size adjustment table that's outlined in statute for the department to use in adjusting the school population. In this case, the K-12 school ADM is listed right here at 439. And so what you do is you come down the table here until you find the range that student population falls in, and then you use the equation over here. And so we drop the equation down here. You start out with the 439 and you subtract the first 400 as the formula requires, which leaves you with 39 students. That product is then multiplied by 0.29, which will give you 35.88 students. That is added to the 471.60 to arrive at the adjusted ADM for the elementary school of 507. Then we move to the secondary school. The population here is 360. Once again, we come to our table, come down. It falls in the range here as under reference number 6. We drop the formula down. 250, we subtract 250 students from the 360 to give you the 110. That is then multiplied by the 0.97 to give you 106.7 kids. Added to the 326.1 will give you 432.8.
Representative Stoltz.
Just a real quick question, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. The statutes require a strict adherence to those numbers, or is there any flex through regulation or any variance?
There is no variance through regulation.
No.
Those are
strict numbers. Or have they ever been varied from for example, a smaller school?
No.
Yeah.
Here is the youth facility, you know, serving 10 students. So once again, you can see we come up here, 10 to 19 students, they get a flat 39.6 adjustment, which is listed here. You add up the adjusted ADM for each of the schools, and we arrive at the 979.88 adjusted ADM for school size. The statute.
Okay.
Oh, excuse me, Representative Croft.
I thought you added the 10 into the smallest. There was one slide where you add the alternative school into the largest, but I thought there was also a provision for adding into the smallest. Can you go back one more?
No, I can answer that question. There's a provision in the statute that says if you actually have fewer than 10 students, you get added to the smallest school in the district. So for that purpose, you can count the kids, you just don't get funded as a separate school.
Okay, but it's fewer than 10.
Fewer than 10.
Thank you.
The next step two is the district cost factor. The factors are set out in statute. They range from a low of 1.00, which is the base, Anchorage and a number of other communities, to a high of 1.736. So we take the adjusted school size ADM and we multiply that times the district cost factor. In this case, Gnomes is 1.319 to arrive at the 1.292.46. The next step in our formula requires us to adjust the previous product by 20% for special needs funding.
Representative Lamb.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch you in time on the cost factors. How are the cost factors arrived at? You have, say, Gnome schools or some other schools, and they have certain costs associated with those schools. And I guess the higher the cost, the higher the cost factor, right?
In theory, that's the way it works.
In theory, that's the way it works. But what's the incentive, then, to save cost? Because the more cost they have, the higher the factor they get. Am I incorrect?
And I should probably clarify that. It's not just the more costs they have, the higher the cost factor, but it's the higher cost to do business in that region, the higher the cost factor will be. So the district can't control the cost of fuel, for example. So the higher cost of fuel in the different regions of the state are adjusted for through the district cost factor.
I understand that there are certain costs that you can, in fact, control. The controllable cost, is any way to any incentive to keep those controllable costs down?
Maybe I need to back up a second. The foundation statute requires the Department of Education to review and update the district cost factors. We attempted to do that based on the model that was developed by the McDowell Group when Senate Bill 36 was enacted. We couldn't use that model again. So Legislative Budget and Audit Committee did contract with a firm, the American Institute of Research out of California, to do a cost factor study. They did a report back to the legislature a year ago, or actually 2 years ago, and the legislature did not adopt their recommendations, and in fact, asked ICER to do a peer review of that report, and it's my understanding they're doing some follow-up work on that report right now.
Thank you.
But I guess in response to your question, the cost factors under the statute should be reviewed and updated on a periodic basis. They have not been updated since 1999. The special needs funding is the categorical allocation under the current foundation program. It's to cover or to assist in the cost with special education, except for those students requiring intensive services, gifted talented programs, bilingual, bicultural, and vocational education programs. And Senate Bill 36 required districts to file a plan with the Department of Education how they were going to utilize these funds. All districts complied with that in 1999, and those plans are on file with the department. So here we took the previous adjusted product of 1,292.46, increased it by 20%, and the adjustment is 1,550.95. Students that require intensive services are counted on the last day of the count period. Okay.
You're turning this
off. You're losing me? Okay. So the intensive service funding is based on a one-day count, the last day of the count period. Students have to be on an IEP and receiving services on that last day, which is the fourth Friday in October. And then the funding basically is $22,880 per child that falls in this category. And we take the number of intensive students, multiply them times five, and that product is added to our previous product. So you can see here, Nome has three students that have been identified as requiring intensive services. 3 times 5 is 15. That's added to the 1,550 to get us up to 1,565. The last step in arriving at the district's adjusted ADM is the correspondence funding. Districts that offer correspondence programs, those students are funded at 80% of the base student allocation, which would generate about $3,661 per child. And what we do here is we take the ADM, or the student count for correspondence kids, multiply that times 0.8. In this case, Nome doesn't have any correspondence students, so that's a pretty easy one for us to do. So their adjusted average daily membership is 1,565.95. We multiply that times the base student allocation, which is set in statute at 4,576, to arrive at Nome's basic need, which is $7,165,787. Oh, Mr.
Sounds
Chairman,
like
real
quite a bit, Representative Foster.
Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned earlier, in this handout we have some spreadsheets, and the second to last page of this handout is the calculations that we just went through for Nome. So if you flip there real quickly, you can see under Nome, working from left to right, Nome has 809 students. They have no correspondent students, so the total number of students they're serving is 809. Their adjusted ADM for school size is 979.88. The cost factor is 1.319. Gets us an adjustment of 1,292.46. We increase that by the 20% to get us up to 1,550.95. We add to that the 15 for the special needs to get us to the 1,565, and that's our adjusted ADM for that school district. We do this for every for all 53 school districts, all schools within each district. On page 9 of the handout, you can see we start to determine who's going to pay for this entitlement now that we know what the need is in Nome. Who pays for basic need? As I mentioned earlier, it's required local contribution, federal impact aid dollars, and then what's left over is state aid. Under Senate Bill 174, there was a in 2002, a bill was passed that said you only count 50% of the increase in the property value in calculating the required local contribution for school districts. So, using Nome as the example, the law requires us to use 1999 as the base. So you can see right here, the base value in 1999 was 191 million. In 2004, the value, as determined by the state assessor, is 206. So the difference is 14 million. Senate Bill 174 told us we're only going to count half of that in calculating what the full value of this district will be for calculating required local contribution. So that would be the seven million. That is added to the base of 191 million to get us to the full value for the purposes of calculating education of 199 million 107. The education full value, as we've marked it here, is then multiplied by 0.004 to come up with the 4 mil equivalent, which is $796,000. The foundation statute also says that another way to calculate required local effort is to take 45% of basic need from the prior year. Whichever is less becomes your required local effort. So you can see here very clearly the $796,000 is less than 3 million, so Nome's required local contribution will be the $796,000. Federal impact aid payments school districts receive. Real quickly, the federal impact aid is in lieu of local property taxes. It's for military installations or for students that live on ANCSA lands, Alaska Native Claims Settlement, or BIA lands. These are all lands that are non-taxable due to some kind of federal interaction. We use the dates on the payment vouchers to indicate when a school district has received the payment for the purposes of calculating whether that is included in this year's calculation or if we move it forward to the subsequent year. Under our example of Nome, the total amount that they've received that's eligible for consideration in the state funding formula is $78,599. The federal law has a requirement in it that if a municipality has a local contribution in the state funding formula, we have to treat impact aid in the same proportion that the school district contributes actual local revenue to what they're required. And so, once again, on page 9 of your spreadsheet here, you'll see down column E, impact aid percentage. And you'll see percentages 100%, Aleutians East is at 40.03, Anchorage 56.31. The way we arrive at those percentages is we take a look at how much the school district is has budgeted for appropriations, earnings, in-kind services and other local revenue, and we divide that by the required local contribution to arrive at the percentage. So in this case, Nome, through the previous four categories that I mentioned, is contributing $1.6 million. When we divide that by the 796,000 required local effort, their impact aid ratio is 48.87%. So the impact aid law says you can consider the 78,000. You have to apply this ratio of 48.87. And then under our state law, we said we would deduct 90% of whatever's left to arrive at the deductible impact aid of $34,570. Okay, so the state aid, based on the formula, we started with basic need of $7,165,000. The required local effort, we're going to deduct that, $796,000. Impact aid, $34,000. State aid is $6.3 million. The $6.3 million will be paid out in monthly installments over a 12-month period. We adjust the state aid in the last 3 months of the year for the current year count. Districts are eligible for additional funds above basic need. Those are additional local contributions for those cities that make a tax contribution, or boroughs. Quality school grants and supplemental funding for. The law does have a cap on the amount that districts can contribute over and above what's required. And what the law says is you can contribute the equivalent of 2 mils of your property value or 23% of your basic need in the current year, whichever's greater. And so in this case, you can see 23% generates 1.6 million. So we add the 1.6 million that they're allowed to contribute to what they're required to come up with the maximum local contribution Nome can make to public schools. I should say real quickly that if Nome fails to meet their required local contribution, they are not eligible for state aid, and we withhold state aid until they make that or commit to make that contribution. They cannot exceed the maximum local contribution, or the statute requires us to reduce state aid by the amount they went over.
What's the public policy purpose that serves that cap, and why is it there?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, the reason that is there is because we consider the federal impact aid dollars in our funding formula. And the federal law says if you want to count the federal dollars in your funding formula, you must have an equalized system under the federal definition. And what that federal law says is you cannot have more than 23% disparity between your richest and poorest school districts. Okay. So we put a cap on what local municipalities can contribute, right? I should back up. It can't be more than 25%. So through the state's funding law, we put a cap at 23% to give us some cushion to meet the federal requirement.
Federal requirement that could be a roughly equal or at least not tremendously disproportionate amount of funding amount across the districts.
Correct.
Okay.
And through our state funding formula, we're considering a little over $50 million in federal aid. Mm-hmm. So if we don't meet the equalization provisions of the federal law, that $50 million comes out of our funding formula, which would either require a proration or some kind of formula adjustment to accommodate for that.
If we did that, the districts would still keep their federal money. We just couldn't count it in our formula. They don't lose the money. We lose the offset.
The state of Alaska would lose the offset. But it's important to note that the state doesn't take the federal impact aid. It is just an offset in arriving at how much state aid they're going to receive in the current year.
Thank you.
Okay, we also have under 1417-480 quality school grants. Once again, in statute, it says districts are eligible to receive a grant in the amount of $16 per adjusted ADM, and they have to give us an application and tell us how they're going to spend those funds. Typically, those are used for supplemental service programs to help students that are underachieving. supplemental funding floor, question is, what is it? How is it established and how is it adjusted? The supplemental funding floor provided additional funds to bridge the transition between the old funding formula and the new funding formula that was enacted in 1999. This is just a rough example that I put together. Say a school district was eligible for $1.1 million under the old funding formula, but under the new, they were only eligible for $1 million. The difference between those two, the $100,000, became their supplemental funding floor in the first year of implementation in 1999. This here is the actual calculation for the Nome City School District. In 1999, under the old formula, they were entitled to $5.2 million. Under the new formula, just a little under $5.1 million. So their supplemental funding floor in 1999 was $110,000. All the adjustments to the supplemental funding floor are decreases. It's important to remember that the floor was there to help districts transition to the new funding formula. The decreases occur in two ways. If there's an increase in basic need, which can occur by having more students, or when the legislature increases the base student allocation. And then the second is if you have a decrease in average daily membership. This example here just shows you if we had a district that had 2,100,000 last year or this year. Last year they had 2,050,000. The difference is 50,000. The law requires us to reduce their floor by 40% of the increase. In this case, 40% of 50,000 is 20,000. That would have been subtracted from their 100,000, leaving their supplemental funding floor at 80,000 for this year. This is an example on how it would work through the ADM reduction. You can see here that the district had a reduction of 14% in their ADM. Therefore, the floor was reduced by $14,000.
Mr. Chairman?
When
the McDowell Group developed the model, it was implemented in 1998 and SB 36. Did it include, at least the model formulation, include the inflation component that was later deleted through legislation?
No, it didn't. And in fact, there was a number of the pieces that the model itself didn't include. The model itself got to need. And then how the state was going to pay for that need, they left up to the legislative discussion. In other words, the required local effort, whether or not you consider impact aid, those components were all left up to the legislature to figure out how to get there. But their model just got you to a need is what it did.
Do you know what the annual rate of inflation has been since 1998?
No, but I could get it. I just wanted to back up real quick. You can see here, this is the actual reduction in the supplemental funding floor for Nome. You can see in the first year they had 110,000. Moving into 01, they had a reduction of that floor of 14,000, so they were funded for 95,000 in fiscal year 01. In fiscal year 02, they didn't have any reduction in their funding floor. There wasn't an increase in the base student allocation that year, and their student population would have been stagnant. So there was no adjustment that year. Moving into 03, they had a reduction due to the increase in basic need of 73,000, which brought their floor down to 22,000. And then in FYO floor, their increase, the 40% of their increase exceeded the 22,000. So now Nome City School District is completely transitioned to the new funding floor, to the new funding formula. They no longer receive supplemental funding floor. This is just a reminder that all adjustments to the floor are a reduction. The components of state aid, we start out with the state foundation aid of $6.3 million. Nome no longer has supplemental funding for it. They do get the quality school grant of $25,000. So the total foundation aid through the funding formula is $6.3 million. If insufficient funds are appropriated by the legislature to meet the total entitlements, then all components of the formula are reduced by the same percentage, and that's right in Alaska Statute 1417-400. So I know I've gone kind of fast. The big question is, do you have any questions?
Thank you. I'm glad to know so much
about Noel. Representative Wyrock. Yeah. Oh. What about our good friend from Nome? I guess I should have asked that cell phones be silenced.
Yes, I don't.
I think that's a donut infraction.
He only did three times last year.
At least one day. With that, is there any questions? Representative Foster.
Yeah, Nome was 1.32 on the factor there, and you set the maximum was 1.7. Is there a graph in here showing some of these?
The district cost factors are listed on page 8 by school district, and they will be in column P. And the district with the highest cost factor is Aleutian Region at 1.736. Mr. Chairman, the commissioner is with us today, and,
yes.
And there's a couple more slides that we'd like to share with the committee, if we may.
Please. Okay. Commissioner, it's an honor to have you in the House Finance.
Thank you for the invite. There's two slides that I ask Eddie to include, and I know there's a great deal of interest with all legislators on education funding. And the governor came out with his proposal on education funding very early. And there's been a great deal of discussion with the governor on crafting his proposal. And I thought I would share with you, regardless of where you stand personally or with your constituents on amounts or timing with it, I thought there were two things that might aid as you work through this process. One would be, this information before you, and I apologize to the folks in the back that may not be able to see this, the very steep line going up is a national trend showing the number of teachers that are leaving the profession. And the lower line, the darker line, are the number of teachers entering the profession. So we have this storm that's been brewing for a while, and Alaska is reflected in a similar type of pattern as the national trend. So we have the shortage brewing nationally. The next slide I want to show you, this is specific to Alaska, and this reflects the largest teacher job fair that we have in the state. We've had it for many, many years, and the bars represent, reflecting the numbers on the left, the number of teachers that attend that fair looking for a teaching job in Alaska. And you can see we peaked in 1997 with just under 1,000 people that came saying, I'd like to teach in this state. And you can see a very steep decline with this past April, April job fair. We had less than 300 teachers looking for work. In fact, we had more people there interviewing than there were candidates to interview. What the relationship is with this chart and the presentation today on funding is whether you agree or support the governor's proposal on education funding, I'd like to emphasize the importance of timing on whatever is done with education funding. Many of you are impacted, almost all of you. When decisions aren't made for education funding, you see districts in a position needing to lay off teachers because of their contractual obligations. 10 years ago, we were able to do that and had a very strong possibility of regaining those teachers when funding decisions were made. Today, there's a great market for teachers to look elsewhere, and they do that, and there's a limited market for our district superintendents and school boards to go out and hire. So if we don't keep the teachers that we have and know where our budgets are to fill the needs that become available, our pool shrinks dramatically, and many of our districts are having to go out of state right now to fill vacancies. And even that is not giving us great results because it's a national issue. It's not just an Alaska issue. So I would certainly encourage the work that you go through in funding the K-12 formula. That early is very, very important. Forward is wonderful, and I know there's different feelings on forward, but it's very critical because of the shortage we're looking at, timing to get quality and keep the people we have.
Representative Jules, did you have a question?
Yeah, I'm not sure how to ask it, so I'll fumble with it. What would happen, given that shortage of, you know, are all, I guess I'll ask several tiers, are we able to fill the positions that are needed throughout the districts in Alaska? Are all the districts coming up with the teachers that they're needing?
No.
So their districts have vacancies for, for teaching in teaching positions.
Districts are oftentimes not able to fill particular positions with candidates who hold the qualifications that they would like in there. And in fact, this legislature and past legislatures have taken action to broaden the pool potential for districts to fill those positions.
Now, I'm trying to make a correlation here, and I don't know if they're going to meet. But what's our dropout rate right now? And what would happen, given that we have this shortage of teachers that have to meet all of these qualifications, and there was no dropouts? What would then happen to our classroom sizes in being able to meet all of the stuff with not only our own stuff? But would that present a problem of a different kind? Because we do have a pretty high dropout rate in terms of students.
I want to put some numbers to look at that. I don't know that I could answer the question. I don't know what the impact would be. We fit a national pattern of turnover in Alaska, and that is the first 5 years of the teaching profession, almost 50% of them make a decision to go elsewhere to a different profession. So we have this revolving door that's happening as a profession.
I understand that about the profession. I'm just wondering, as it relates to students and retaining students in the classroom, how that begins to correlate in terms of do we have enough space? Do we have the right mix and qualifications of teachers, and with the understanding that we do have probably a pretty high dropout rate throughout the state.
There's clearly some areas that have more of a shortage than others. I think that the fix to the problem, knowing what funding is one small slice to fix. It's just one part of it, and we need to approach it on multiple fronts. And one is increase retention rates for the staff that we do have, and increase of their qualifications across broad bases as well.
Representative Croft.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you go back to the slide that has the decline in? Mr. Kusher, that's a disturbing trend. It's worth as we think about how we retain more of our teachers and how we attract more from the rest of the nation, it seems to me an attractive retirement package for our teachers is an important component of that. And why would this be a time that the administration is proposing a new Tier 3 on TERS that it seemed would make us even less competitive with the rest of the nation on retirement issues?
I'll give you at least one view of how it might be looked at. We looked at national data as to why teachers leave the profession. why do we have so many leaving as opposed to entering? Salary was not one of the top three reasons that in surveys they said they lacked it or benefits. That was not why most people enter teaching. It's not because of the money, and it's not because of the benefits. It's for other reasons. The top two reasons for those leaving the profession were because they didn't feel supported, or they didn't feel like they were competent or had enough exchange professionally through colleagues to know when they were doing a good job and get constructive feedback. It was those two reasons that through the national surveys they said, I made a decision to leave this profession. So I think the thought of looking at a different tier is purely economical for the TERS and the PERS, but for TERS in particular, I think it's purely economical as what can the state afford. Will it have an impact on the draw to Alaska? I don't know. But I do know where we used to attract with very high salaries, and we're not doing that now, we're taking steps that we hope will foster that while we increase quality. And one of those would be what we've moved forward with the Alaska State Teacher Mentor Process, where we are now mentoring 370 teachers across the state as they come in. And we're doing that for up to 2 years to increase quality and try to get that retention rate much higher for the teachers that do come to us. If that is effective, again, the 14 years of research on the model that we're moving forward says that it will be effective, we're addressing that support and that reflective instruction bouncing off of colleagues, that model.
So you think we can pay them less or less in benefits, but through other mechanisms reverse that trend?
I think that we can enhance and create strong incentives to come and work in this state in addition to or besides just dollars and benefits. I think that those are also two very strong incentives, don't get me wrong, but I think it is something we need to look at as a total state. We would love to have more money for all of the services that we provide, in education and beyond. We would love to be able to attract the very best with a dollar sign. But we also have to be realistic about what can we sustain, and are there other things that we can do that people will come here for quality of life and quality of food.
And you referenced it. We used to pay a lot more than the national average, and is that's diminished, at least over the last 10 years?
No, we used to rank very, very high on salaries in relationship to others. It's not that our salaries have gone down. Others have come up. Inflation has become a factor. If I'm not mistaken, we're still in the top 5% for beginning teacher salaries.
Just not for the older teachers, but the beginning salary is
right.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Jewell?
No.
No?
He asked the question.
I would just have one comment, too, is that apparently this is not only Alaska trend, but it's nationwide, and I would be interested in seeing if you have any information on other states and the problems that they're having, and I'm sure that we're not talking about anything that's new just to the state of Alaska. I think it is nationwide. Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we have a similar graph like that that shows a projection of students? I mean, is the number of students anticipated to go up in the next 5-10 years?
Through the chair, Representative Meyer. The student population in Alaska right now is relatively stable. Mr. Jeans can probably assist me in this, but I believe it's the fluctuation between the past couple of years has not been more than 600 students. But it's quite steady right now, but you do have districts in the state that are on very steep increases, such as the Mattsu Valley, which you probably heard of last year. But we've seen some decreases in rural Alaska. Overall, the population's been quite stable.
Yeah, and if I continue, the number of homeschoolers, is that about 5%, and is that a steady number to public?
That number was on the increase. When you say homeschool, those that were taking something other than the typical brick-and-mortar school, neighborhood school, was on the increase until a year ago. This year we actually saw a decline in enrollment in those programs. But the actual true homeschool that doesn't receive any funding from the state of Alaska, we don't know the numbers of those kids. We have no way to recognize who those kids are. No way to track them.
Thank you. And then if I can continue just for a second. By the way, I really appreciate you coming here today, Commissioner. And, of course, you also. I see you all the time. A student's transfer, how does the money flow? For example, if a student in Nome, which we know are well-funded and well-educated, transfers to Anchorage, does that person headcount stay in the Nome school district? And when does Anchorage pick it up in their headcount or in their funding for students?
Representative Meyer, the dollars don't flow like we would think would be a normal way to do that. The count period that Mr. Dean refers to, that 20 days in the month of October, establishes where the dollars go. And when a student leaves after that, there's no dollars that go from Nome to that school that the student goes with. And it seems like that's a broken system, but there's some legitimate reasons for that. You hire teachers, you put them under contract, you purchase supplies for the kids that are in those seats, and when they go, you still have the obligation for that. There are times, though, that if that change occurs prior to the count period, and there's times that there's only partial funding for Nome if that student moved in the middle of October, Nome would get part of that funding, and whatever the receiving school district the student went to would get part of that funding.
Very good. And then finally, refresh my memory, maybe Eddie, this is a question for you. Is there a study going on, a cost difference study? That actually, I think it came up last year and we revised it. Refresh my memory on the status of it.
Actually, there is a Legislative Budget Audit Committee contracted with the American Institute for Research to do a district cost factor study that was submitted 2 years ago. A year ago, the legislature asked ICER to do a peer review of that. ICER found some deficiencies in that study, and it's my understanding that they're reviewing that, running some of their own numbers, and they're supposed to file a new report with the legislative budget and audit.
All right, thank you.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I was interested in a couple of comments that you made and one that you didn't make. My wife was a school teacher in Alaska for 31 years and retired just this year. And having said that, one of the biggest reasons that she retired had nothing to do with money or had nothing to do with some of the things you brought up, but had to do with class size. The other part of it was specifically the support. The lack of district support in deference to parental support, which didn't want a parent. So I just want to make that comment because I think that's a huge issue with class size in terms of how teachers can respond to their students and how they can feel productive. And if they have larger and larger class size, especially in the younger students in the elementary school. It appears to me from what you say, if we look at this disturbing graph here, that there's an employment opportunity in the state of Alaska for creating our own teachers. What are your comments with regards to our educational system and providing enough teachers to support the educational needs of our district?
We've been working closely with the president of the Alaska University System, as well as the education departments of each campus, including the private colleges that we have in Alaska, on how do we enhance both the number and the quality of candidates coming out there. The numbers that they're producing of eligible teachers, it is increasing. Even at the highest numbers they produce, it's about 20% of the need that Alaska is seeing on an annual basis. So they are capable of taking more into their teacher preparation programs, but they're not getting more applicants to come in that want to go into that career. So there is a push to have students take a look and consider this as a career earlier. But there are also other careers where people are pushing them to take a look at those areas as well. But right now, Alaska University teacher preparation programs are producing about one out of every five teachers of Alaska.
Thank you.
Mr.
Thank you. Representative Lynn.
Two things. I wonder if you might, you indicated a lack of support. I wondered if you could define what you mean by a lack of support. Then I had a comment after that.
I'll give it a try. It was a generalized comment that came from teachers across the country. This was a national study, but we hear it at home. You'll hear it in your districts, and we'll hear it from districts across the state, rural and urban, and I think it's a little different from most. But oftentimes, it's feeling like the plate is so full that they don't get support either from the district administration in some cases, or they don't get support from parents, they don't get support from the community. Oftentimes, there's actions taken or lack of actions that absolutely are perceived by the classroom teacher as not being supported. A student that doesn't show up, a student that doesn't develop, a student that is out of line with behavior, depending on the action that's taken by the parent, community, principal, whoever the appropriate source is to deal with that, oftentimes is not viewed by the teachers being supported. And so it's a combination of actions by others, as well as the needs that they see for meeting the needs of students, whether it's a lack of dollars to buy materials for them, time to deliver the instruction, the curriculum that's been adopted by the district. Many, many things are playing into why they don't feel supported. We have some great schools and we have some great administrators and teachers in the state. If this is not intended to reflect on them, it's a symptom in many cases, even in our best schools, because of class size, because of what we've asked our students to do, can't get it all done. And in return, they don't feel like they're being supported.
If I may, I am a retired school teacher. I retired teaching in another state with regular and special ed. I taught 1 year in Alaska schools before I was one of those people who left. And I would submit that some of the problems teachers have, lack of support and so on, problems in the classroom, is really beyond anybody's control at the local level, because we have federal mandates that, for special ed kids. We have these inclusionary programs that seem to be the rage now. And the inclusionary, I'm not saying this is good or bad, I'm just saying what is. You get these kids in an inclusionary program, including severely emotionally disturbed kids, SED, and so on in there, and they are truly emotionally disturbed. And an inordinate amount of time is spent dealing with these children rather than the other kids who fall through the cracks. And you get this revolving door thing where you have a SED kid, and then he's sent to time out because he threw a chair across the room. Then from there he comes back to the resource room or someplace. And then he goes back to the classroom, and this goes on and on and on. And the teacher gets frustrated about this, and many teachers would say, enough already. And I know it's part of that, not to fault of the particular school, it's the entire system we've gotten into. The one example is resource kids, resource development kids. There's a tremendous increase in those kids who are not doing well in one particular area end up being a resource kid. We're all handicapped one way or another, some more than others. And so if you look long enough, everybody could be a resource kid. And I see Paula also asked the foundation partner, I found out today. And so I think this is part of the problem of why we're losing teachers, and why it's not just an Alaska problem, it's a national problem, because we have these same problems all over the place. And I'm surprised teachers last 5 years sometimes, what they have to put up with. And class size, obviously, is part of the problem. When I first started teaching back in 1959 or 60, I think it was, I had 43 kids in the fifth grade class. Didn't have near the problems that we have now in 20 student classes. And part of that is because of these other programs that have been put down on us because of special education law. So I believe I have a great heart for special education kids. Please don't misunderstand what I'm saying here. But we are creating our own Frankenstein, it seems like.
I think that many educators that are in this room now and across the state appreciate the perspective that you have, because you describe very well what some frustrations are. I'm committed that they entered the profession to help kids, and they're dedicated to young people and doing a good job. And they get very frustrated early with
burnout.
Representative Wyrock.
20 years. Now it's 5 years. Oh.
Excuse me. When you started teaching, did you have books or parchment paper?
I had stone and a chisel.
Oh, yeah. What, Representative Wyrock?
Mr. Chairman, as one of those former resource kids, I appreciate the. I have another committee meeting I have to go to, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to leave, but I think that it should not be go unnoticed that the governor wanted to have a substantial amount of education funding early on, and that the very first meeting of this committee is education, and it shows how important it is to the majority in the legislature, at least in the House, to move early on this and how we value education. And so I think it's a real tribute to your leadership to put this right in front of the public early on, and it certainly is a priority of ours, and I think the rest of this majority. So I think that's a very important symbol, Mr. Chairman.
I think that the majority of us do feel indeed that way as far as education funding, and the children of Alaska. Did you have a question, Representative Hocker?
No, sir.
Any other questions?
I just wanted to get a copy of these charts.
He's not here yet. Representative Stoltz.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman Schmoll. I have a question about homeschools. There's a lot of folks just wondering what the status is, what the administration's position is going to be. I know there's been incidents in the Valley, and the first thing pointed at was, I don't disagree with the connection that, boy, that sure wouldn't have happened if we had more controls on homeschools. And the folks who I know the governor values, because he really solicited them during the 2002 election, I'm just really, because I know a lot of them are listening, what is the administration's position on homeschools and additional regulation? And I guess I'm throwing a softball to give you a chance to tell us what we want to hear.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz. The administration has been pro-choice from the beginning, as long as I've been associated with them. They want to give parents choice to match needs that they see for their child with opportunities that are out there. They've been supportive of that. But in the same time they've been supportive, and you've heard the governor say it many times, he's willing to support more dollars for education, but he wants the exchange to be give us levels of accountability that go with that. And choice goes, homeschool is one choice, correspondence schools are choices, charter schools are choices. There's lots of different choices out there. But he wants them all to make sure that they're addressing high standards and accountable for the dollars that they receive.
Mr. Chairman, I was, kind of looking at some of the folks at education institutions. There's been some editorializing about responsibilities of schools and homeschools, and I think you know where I'm standing on this. But are we going to expect any new regulations coming from your department or new oversight directing? I'm not talking about the fiscal accountability. I think there's been some jealousy among other education parts of the education of the homeschools and some of the results and the fact that they don't have accountability or a thumb on as much a thumb on them as they want. I guess I'm just fishing for some assurances, and if it's ambiguity, I'll carry that back to our constituency. That's fine.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, I just want to understand your question. When you talk about homeschool, are you talking about those that are non-funded entities?
Talking about both of them, and I.
A year ago, the State Board took action on putting some regulations in place to provide more oversight into statewide correspondence programs, specifically as it dealt with fund accounts and the use of state dollars. Part of that oversight was to do monitoring on those statewide programs. That is underway now, and we are identifying some areas that programs are going to need to step to the plate to and do a better job with.
I'm not articulating my, maybe I'm just, maybe Kevin Jardell's listening, he can talk to me later.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually broke the subject of one of my favorite words, accountability. And if you don't mind, could you flip to the next chart? And just, this is going to be a long discussion that we all have, but I think it's probably a good time to, you know, bring up something that this chart illustrates, components of your department's, the governor's proposal to us. Two words at the bottom there, commitment and accountability. You know, I go through that list and I see a lot of commitment there, sincere, real commitment. But I also see the word accountability at the bottom, and I don't see anything about accountability on that chart. Can you give me putting this much additional resource into this, I'm wondering, and I know I'm going to be asking an awful lot about what is this accountability word you've got down here, and how is it involved in what you're doing?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Hawker. There's two ways that accountability has been asked to be shown. One is through the federal government way, and that's been, you've all heard about No Child Left Behind and AYP, Adequate Human Progress. We've been reporting that for the past few years. That's one indication whether schools are making more progress and students are doing more. It's flawed greatly. And so we're developing, and in fact we'll be ready to roll it out, a true growth model. And by a true growth model, this is going to be able to show even the schools that have been meeting AYP may or may not have necessarily shown growth. And there are schools that didn't meet AYP that made tremendous growth. So we're going to be able to report out the performance kids year to year and school to school that indicates the amount of growth, not where they hit a predetermined bar that's a moving target.
Quick follow-up. Okay, so testing is part of the accountability factor.
Yes.
I don't want to go at length here, but that seems to be a sort of pretty limited perspective on accountability here. I think we'll just, without going on, I'd sure like to develop, if you're going to truly sell me on the package, we've really got to be able to demonstrate to the people that are going to be paying for it, you know, what all they're going to get for their money.
I agree.
And thank you, sir.
Representative Jewell.
That was actually my line of questioning. You know, given that we raised student allocations last year, we kind of had the same discussion about accountability as we move towards addressing the budget this year and proposed increases. Are we going to see what we got for the increase last year and what we're proposing to get with the proposed increase in this upcoming budget year in terms of accountability?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell.
I think that there will be instances that could be shown, but we are a local control state when it comes to delivering of services district by district. And some districts can show different levels of accountability based on their priorities and their local goals and how they've applied that. It would not take away from one from another because the goals are different. There are some that I think that are relatively uniform across our state, the adopted content standards and performance standards in reading, writing, and math. But different districts have other priorities beyond those, and their success in meeting those will be different, greatly different.
Any other questions? Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Two points. The special student categories. Could you tell me how many, the percentage of students in each of the categories of the special categories, and then the percentage of students in each of the categories, and then the percentage of the dollars that go to those two categories, or three, or whatever you mentioned. And then the other, just one other comment on why teachers leave. One personal story of a person that just left the program or is about to, I guess left last fall. Discipline, students' rights, and disruption factor. And I've had it, is what he said. And he's got several years in him that we could get out of him if he didn't throw it over for something else. And then he kind of ended by saying, I loved it, but I'm not sticking around. So, and the other one then was these categories, percentages, and dollars.
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, I believe you're asking about the 20% for special ed and bilingual and voc ed. It is simply a block grant to assist school districts with those programs. It wasn't intended to be broken down into further components for each of those programs. Prior to Senate Bill 36, we did provide funding based on the number of kids being served in each of those programs, but we saw in special education and in the bilingual programs, they were growing at a rate that was much faster than the general student population was, and it was a decision at that time to go to a block funding mechanism. Part of that also has to do with the state of Alaska's funding mechanism. It simply allocates money, and it's discretionary on the school board to allocate those resources how they best see fit. In many other states, their special education and other programs are reimbursable programs. So they actually have to enroll the kids, they incur the expense, and then they bill the state. But because ours doesn't work that way, at that point in time, it makes sense to go to a block allocation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a comment. I have the pleasure of having your budget again this year. Just wanted to give you a heads up that Representative Hawker and I will be looking at the, I refer to as chargebacks. I think they're called RSAs or something. The money you're charging, like the arts, the libraries, the museums, the archives, those type of organizations. And I guess one disappointment I had from this year's budget over last year's, and I know we're not here to talk about the budget, it's just that, if you need that amount of money for the overhead, to support these other groups that fall within education, it's best to just show that up front. So, and I don't know, I haven't looked at this year's budget if that's the way you can figure it out.
Through the chair, Representative Meyer, you're going to be happy when you see the budget item.
I'm going to be happy. All right, good.
Some of those items that you were talking about are included.
I like to be
direct
happy.
Items.
I think Representative Hawker likes me.
We like happy legislators.
Representative Hawker.
They like happy legislators. With that, if there's no other questions, Eddie, thank you for putting on the presentation. Or Commissioner, thank you for being here.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you very much, and we look forward to working with you again.
Thank you. Before I close the meeting, an idea of what's coming up next week. Monday's a holiday, so we'll have no meeting. Our first meeting will be Wednesday at 1:30. We will have an overview on the PERS and TERS system. And then on January 21st, we'll have Department of Revenue in and look at revenue projections, and also the Department of Health and Social Services, and look at proposed changes in the Medicaid reimbursement program. If there are any other overviews that you would like to see in the next week or two, contact me and I will see if we can arrange it. I would like to leave some, unless they're of utmost importance. I think we have three or four issues out there that are big issue items that we can bring before the full committee, but I would rather see us take some of the other smaller issues and bring those up in subcommittee.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Meyer.
If I may, when revenue speaks to us. I'd like for them to do more than just this is our forecast for price oil and this is how much revenue we expect to get. I'd also like to find out a little more detail about the proposed Amerada Hess and using some of those proceeds for bonding purposes, as well as other bond funds like Aetna, ADA, I guess Alaska Housing, and
Student Loan Corp.
Student Loan Corp. Maybe get a better understanding of the revenue from those folks, as well as the $37 million line of credit that the administration has proposed using. You know, how that's going to be backed up with what general funds or some fund source. So when you set that up with the revenue, hopefully they'll get into more details.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Hearing none, we'll adjourn.